Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that's on the march. My name's Corey Hazelhurst and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hello.
We also have for the second time in this series, Dr. Charlotte Galpin, who is a lecturer in German and European politics at the University of Birmingham. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Corey.
Now, in this episode, we're talking about France and Germany for the first time since our 2016 end-of-year review episode. Now, in Germany, it seems like, to quote our doomed Prime Minister, nothing has changed. But in France, there's been a political revolution, and not for the first time. So what does the rise of Macron mean for populism and for Brexit? That's what we're discussing after this. So Steve, Emmanuel Macron has been going around France and stirring up apathy, has he not?
Seemingly, no, not at all. Off the back of the presidential election in France, which obviously Macron was victorious in when he was up against Marine Le Pen, there was a kind of a hot take which was doing the rounds in British circles, which was people weren't voting for Macron, they were voting against the Front National and against Marine Le Pen. Turnout was slightly down in comparison to previous elections, and clearly this was as much a victory for apathy as it was for Macron. However, since then, we've seen polling and voting, which seems to put Macron on course for Macron and En Marche, his party, on track for a significant majority. I don't know quite if it counts as landslide, which is not, to be honest, apathetic.
308 out of 577 seats in the Assembly were won by En Marche, which that's landslide, definitely. However, there were 43% of people voted in those elections, which is, I think, a historic low. And of those people who voted, so of that 43%, 10% of those votes, either they had a blank ballot paper or they spoilt their vote. Why is that? Is that just because these are people who would like to vote for the more established parties and didn't want to lend Macron their vote? Or is it that they just don't want to stop his agenda going through?
I suspect it's probably, if you dig into it, you'll probably find that a lot of those spoiled ballots were probably from the supporters of people like Jean-Luc Mélenchon, who was effectively the communist candidate. So these are individuals who are very much of the almost stereotypical left-wing branch of, we couldn't possibly vote for this centrist because there's absolutely no difference between him and the fascist. Mélenchon himself did not come out and actively support Macron, instead saying he would simply consult their members and their followers and voters to see what they wanted to do, which is a direct contrast to the more traditional left-wing parties who outright backed Macron, as did François Fillon and the traditional right, along with Nicolas Sarkozy. Yeah.
Mélenchon's kind of an interesting figure, isn't he, Charlie? Because he reminds me a little bit of people like Jeremy Corbyn and people like Bernie Sanders, who, but their views haven't really changed in 30, 40 years, and they're all on the degrees of far left. I mean, certainly in terms of the politics of the countries they're in, they're all kind of far left, but they're all quite successful in various ways at getting those young people that we hear so much about to go to their rallies and use social media and new technology and get them involved.
I think he definitely had kind of a surge in the polls in the run-up to the presidential election, and similar to Corbyn, I think, stir up kind of left-wing populism in kind of a similar way that Corbyn did.
I think one of the interesting things again about Mélenchon is, again, almost a direct comparison to Jeremy Corbyn here in the UK, is an awful lot of his boost came off the back of debates. There's an awful lot when it comes to these kind of far left, for lack of a better term, kind of figures, that when they are actually put in a position where they can talk directly to people in one form or another, they are able to get their point across much more effectively. Which I think is one of the interesting things about, certainly with how Mélenchon was trying to kind of do his campaigning, where there was an interesting little kind of period where he was just utilising an awful lot of holograms. So where he was on one side of the country, just appearing physically physically at a rally, that would then end, and then 20 minutes later, he'd be appearing, quote-unquote, as a hologram at another rally, making a big ploy about the fact that I'm actually in Paris right now, or whatever.
If Arnold Rimmer was a French presidential candidate, he would be Jean-Luc Mélenchon.
That would be amazing.
I think the interesting thing in France is how, I think this is maybe a pattern that we're seeing in other countries as well, that the major parties are, so none of the major parties has a candidate in the second round of the presidential election, and in the recent parliamentary elections, I think the Socialist Party has had a historically low number of seats. I can't remember how many it is, but I think it was something like 11% that they
got
at the end. And I guess this kind of explains both low turnout, but also support for En Marche and National Front, that it seems people are disillusioned with the main parties, the established parties. Perhaps they haven't seen much change to their situation over the France's economic situation has been difficult for a long time. And
I suppose it's a particular genius of Corbyn's campaign that he was able to try and get most of the votes of a mainstream social democratic party and then get that kind of populist protest vote wing as well. But and the interesting thing about Macron, he's not even someone we talked about in the end of year review, Steve. He denounced his candidacy, but it was always this kind of centrist outsider. I don't think anyone gave him any chance whatsoever. So what explains that rise? How can a Rothschild banker be a populist anti-establishment candidate?
At essence, it's that there's a desire for change in an awful lot of the world at the moment. You can see it in the US where they voted for Trump over Clinton. You can see it in the UK after the general election, where Labour had a much stronger performance than most people thought was possible. And obviously you can see it in France with the rise, with the presidential election, where it became New Party versus the Front National. Macron was able to tap into that, despite being, from the background he has, effectively being a member of the elite, going to the elite bureaucrat civil service school. I think in France, it helped that there was such a direct contrast between himself and the Front National. I think if it had been Macron versus the traditional right, or Macron versus Benoît Hamon, or indeed versus Mélenchon, you'd have seen a very different election and a very different, potentially, outcome. Not necessarily saying that Macron would lose, but I think the margin would obviously have been lower. So I think for France, it boils down to the fact that people are annoyed, want something different, and the options that they were presented with, Macron was the most palatable. But before this, a lot of the kind of populists that had done well, whether that be Britain voting to leave, Brexit, or Trump, were very much pushed by the right. We've now got evidence that those things don't necessarily work out very well. Europe looks at Trump and sees, oh my God, this isn't a positive. And yet we've got Marine Le Pen, AFD and things like that, who are trying to emulate that kind of style. They look at Brexit and they see the mess, as we discussed on a previous episode, that Britain is finding itself in. And they see, oh God, that hasn't worked out either. So to a certain extent, they're looking for an alternative, but they're looking for a plausible one. And I think Macron presents that. He's able to present a reassuring image of someone who's able to say, I am not your regular kind of candidate, I am not a part of the elite, whilst also looking like one, which, without being funny, in politics, that matters. Sometimes that's a negative, but I think in Macron's case, given the context, that's been a massive positive for him.
Is part of it authenticity, which I suppose is another big thing that people like Corbyn, people like Sanders, people like Mélenchon, and even people like Trump. I mean, what you see is what you get with a lot of that. I mean, people like Farage as well. There's a kind of a no BS about them, which I think Macron has as well, and say someone like Clinton or Theresa May don't have.
Well, that's also, related to not being part of the establishment as well, that he doesn't have a lot of political experience, so he's able to convey a much different impression. I think what's also worth noting in the final round of the presidential election is that this also came down to a choice between the anti-European candidate or the pro-European candidate. And one thing that the National Front are now talking about is, they're recognising that being anti-Euro really damaged them in the election, and because the French don't want to leave the euro and they do want to stay in the European Union. And it came down, I think, also to about, you know, what is the place of France in Europe and what kind of values.
You thought they'd want sovereignty, really, but
take back control.
How important was Macron's European identity? Because always at rallies he had the EU flag behind him in a way I don't think any, not even Tim Farron, would have the EU flag behind him at campaign events.
There were a couple of instances where he did, where you would find the EU flag next to the Union Jack behind Tim Farron. But you know, certainly in the UK, there are few and far between that would adopt.
I suppose, a mainstream politician, maybe. But how important was Macron's EU identity in terms of his win then, do you think?
France has a very different relationship with the EU than the UK does, and what the French did quite successfully was construct a kind of French identity as part of Europe, where kind of French values, republican values, were seen as very compatible with Europe, and that these were kind of overlapping. That's something that Macron challenged quite well, and I think he really positioned himself as the pro-European candidate. And you mentioned that in light of Brexit and Trump, I think this has been really important for also galvanizing pro-European support on the continent, because people are looking at Brexit and seeing how difficult it is to actually leave the EU, and also they're very concerned that the EU might actually collapse, and the euro might collapse, and you know, they might be critical of the EU and its Eurozone policies, for example, but they don't want to leave, they want to reform it. And so I think that what actually an interesting side effect of Brexit is that it actually seems to be helping the rest of the EU27 unify and to push forward European integration.
Yeah, there's been, since Brexit, an interesting kind of trend in the polling that's been coming out of like the EU27 nations, which is in effect a rise in support for the EU amongst pretty much every demographic. It essentially boils down to, I think, that they're seeing that the grass isn't greener on the other side, because Britain's going through it right now, and they're seeing the absolute farce that's turning out to be, and all the difficulties that Britain is having.
I suppose it's Britain's greatest contribution to European integration since John Major helped pass Maastricht probably 25 years ago.
Yeah, and it's slightly facetious, but also very, very true.
This is what's interesting, is I hear a lot on the continent that there's this confusion about Brexit, because Britain is seen as having been a fundamental player in the development of the European Union. Thatcher helped create the single market, Major with the Maastricht Treaty, and all of these criticisms that particularly also left-wing Eurosceptics in the UK have about the EU as this neoliberal organisation. Well, this is the UK's doing. We've been one of the primary drivers of that. Particularly in France, I think there are sections of the French population that would actually be quite happy if we left the EU, because that's then a chance to push forward a more social agenda.
Hence, people in Denmark are quite unhappy that we're leaving, because I suppose in Britain and Denmark we joined at the same time, and they share a similar attitude to us, I suppose, on the EU.
Yeah, and like, so when Cameron negotiated did the renegotiation, and one of the things that he secured was this agreement of an emergency break on benefits to EU citizens, and that was quite popular in Denmark, because Denmark also has a lot of debates about EU citizens getting support in the Danish welfare state, which is quite generous. And so I think what many people in Denmark were hoping is that if Britain remains in the EU and Cameron's deal then took effect, so that would also be something that other member states could take advantage of. So when we voted to leave and that deal then fell away, they're actually kind of disappointed.
So it's like we should work with other countries rather than...
Yeah.
Oh, don't be silly.
No, sorry. Before we go on to Germany, I have to say I'm a little bit worried about France under Macron, and there's a couple of reasons for that. So, as I say, there's a big parliamentary majority, and a lot of them are people who've never been politicians before, which is, in one sense, is really, really good, especially from a country which has got quite an entrenched political class. You know, there's people who are tech entrepreneurs there are head teachers, police commanders are there, there's people who've run hospitals there, and economists.
Yeah, they've got quite a good gender diversity. I think they've got a relatively good ethnic diversity amongst their members as well.
Yeah, and something like now 40% of the assembly is women MPs, which is up from a quarter last time.
And that's purely because of En Marche.
Yeah, apparently En Marche made sure they had 50-50 gender split, which is great. Because obviously these people are not professional politicians, and one has sense that's really, really good. But because they're new to politics and to the parliament, I wonder if you might end up with a bit of a New Labour 1997 thing, where you end up with lots of new MPs who don't know a lot about governing have to be taught how to govern. And in that sense, you end up with a very centralised leader's office telling them what to do. Certainly the Macron campaign has been quite centralised so far. I can see even more of a centralising in its methods and more of a top-down approach rather than the bottom-up in terms of telling these delegates what to do.
I mean, there is a risk of that, but one of the things with any kind of new political movement or new political party is that you don't know what it's going to actually look like or how it's actually going to function. This is a first in France. This is the first pretty much in Europe as a whole.
Pretty first in the world, I would guess.
So we don't know, there's nothing really to compare it or benchmark it against. So yes, there are all kinds of things which could happen, which could go wrong, but at the same time, the complete opposite is also feasible. Both the beauty and the danger of En Marche in terms of this sort of stuff is that we just don't know.
So people say, I can't remember the exact phrasing, but people say that France is kind of a republic with a monarchy, and that the tradition is that French presidents have been very powerful, and you know, people like Mitterrand, de Gaulle, and I wonder whether actually, if it does happen that Macron ends up, you know, he has a strong majority, and that whether it will be kind of a continuation of the kind of norm in France.
Well, interesting you should talk about how you might have a strong executive, because according to Le Monde anyway, who's seen a leaked copy of the bill, that Macron wants to try and turn emergency powers at the moment existing in France because of the various terror attacks that have happened there, wants to incorporate them into the main constitution, which means that it's bad if you're any kind of civil libertarian. You know, you've got police raiding on the whim, you've got suspects only being confined to a certain geographical area. It's the kind of thing that if Marine Le Pen had said it within the first month or two of her presidency, everyone would have been kicking off and liberal Europe would have gone insane. But because it's Macron doing it and he looks quite nice and he has an EU flag behind him and he is photographed with Justin Trudeau in Sicily looking like some sort of European Brokeback Mountain, that somehow that's okay.
I think with most forms of, in effect, for lack of a better term, the radical centre, which is certainly the kind of positioning that Macron has put himself out on. And you can see this in Britain with Tony Blair. You could see it to a certain extent actually with Nick Clegg as well during the coalition, is that even if in opposition they kind of might have been quite good on civil liberties, there seems to be a kind of a drag towards more of a authoritarian. Not necessarily they become authoritarians themselves, but they, in the case of Clegg, for instance, allowed more authoritarian measures to get through just as part of the coalition deals. Blair, you know, his record on civil liberties was never brilliant to begin with.
I think patchy, maybe we could say.
Let's say patchy.
Verging on not very good.
So I think it's one of the quite potentially interesting areas where the radical centre, and I say this as someone whose Twitter handle is centre radical, it can be very bad. On this, there seems to be at points this disjunction in a lot of ways between civil liberties and trying to find this, you know, that mystical third way or doing things differently.
I wonder if that's because the whole point, I suppose, of the radical centre, the kind of the Blairite, and you say a lot as well, is that what matters is what works.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose if you're in a state of emergency, you've had your terror attacks,
what works is these sorts
massive
of things.
Police crackdown. However, that's not Very liberal.
I think it seemed that the conclusion from, you know, following terrorist attacks in France over the last couple of years, one of the problems identified was with the intelligence organisations. Things like intelligence sharing and all of these processes weren't working properly. So it seems like there's some things that need to change. It's just a matter of
how
far it goes. And I haven't actually seen much detail yet on what Macron's proposing.
The other thing, and it's a point that was made on the Cambridge Politics podcast, which is very, very interesting. The whole point, I suppose, of being anti-politics and not being professional politicians, one thing is very, very good. On the other hand, it might mean the compromises of politics where you actually need to get your bills through, and that inability to compromise might hamper the ability of Macron to get an agenda through, especially if you are in that radical centre where the lefties might not want to vote for the right-wing bills and the right-wingers might not want to vote for the left-wing parts of the agenda. Well, is there going to be an appetite for the political horse trading that says we can get these bills through? Maybe I think Steve is just naturally more optimistic and wait and see about these kind of things than I am. But it could end up in, especially if strikes hit, which will happen if Macron tries to reform the labour laws, I can see a lot of paralysis and 4% approval ratings limbering on the horizon.
I mean, there's two things there. There's one, can they demonstrate the pragmatism to actually get things through and deal with the horse trading? Which I think yes, they can. Yes, the people who are making up the En Marche delegation, Parliament, are not typical politicians, but that doesn't mean they don't know what how to negotiate. That doesn't mean they're all kind of stuck in the mud and kind of going, no, I shall only do it this way. Most of these people are regular people, which, and again, this is where something else comes quite new, going back to your notion of like centralised Macron control, most of them may very well be much more open to persuasion just by the presence or the notion and the virtue of Macron himself. It is a presidential system, after all. And it's the sort of thing where if they need some extra votes, well, these people aren't used to necessarily sitting with the big wigs and having all of those high-profile dinners with very important people. They may very well be much more easy to persuade on a number of those issues. So I'm not, that's cynical. A very cynical way of looking at it, but I think it's realpolitik. I think that's actually how a lot of those things could go down.
He's making an effort to cross the left-right divide, so bringing people from across the spectrum into his cabinet. There's been a new centre-right grouping that has formed, who are saying that they'll support his labour market rules. So I think at the moment it seems as though there are signs that he might be able to create kind of consensus. And
yeah, there seems to be an appetite for what he's actually putting forward. And I think that landslide puts him in a much stronger position to be able to take on trade unions and put through these sorts of reforms. You know, whether you like them or like the reforms or not, it is a clear mandate. Yes, maybe he has to burn up a significant amount of political capital, but given that a lot of his manifesto and agenda is around these sorts of things, burning that political capital on those projects isn't necessarily a bad thing from their perspective. You know, it is entirely possible his ratings drop down, but I think it takes an awful lot to get down to the levels of François Hollande.
Doesn't it just... Hopefully he won't find a younger version of his wife to have an affair with, like Hollande kept doing.
Or stop bragging about, extra governmental assassinations.
That would be useful. That's our main tip. Let's go on to Germany. Angela Merkel, leader of the free world. There's a German election, I think, in September, isn't it?
Yes.
Right.
September.
How's it looking for her?
Quite good at the moment. So I think for a while there was, particularly the height of the refugee crisis, her prospect at re-election was looking quite unlikely, and she had a big drop in support. But this year she's managed to regain a lot of support in the polls. So it now looks as though CDU are on 39%. She will quite easily be re-elected in September. The main question is who will be her coalition partner. How well does AfD do? How badly does SPD do?
So in case you're not sure, CDU is the Christian Democrats for Merkel's party. AfD are the
Alternative for Deutschland.
And they're basically
Nazis.
Well, SDP are the Social Democrats. They're led by, Schulz.
What's his name? Martin Schulz.
Martin Schulz. In Germany, it's an additional member system, isn't it? What do you actually need for a majority there?
They basically always have coalitions. So last election, the CDU almost had an outright majority, I think, but didn't quite make it. So they will have to make form a coalition with someone. It will end up depending on the final numbers. The possibilities could be that people are talking about. I mean, the obvious one, which has been before, would be CDU and FDP, the Liberal Party, kind of centre-right liberals. And then people are also floating the idea of a CDU-Green coalition, but that's probably quite unlikely. Regional Parliament in Baden-Württemberg has a CDU-Green coalition, so it's not unheard of. I think there might have been other states that have as well. Yeah, it's never happened at national level. The other thing that's talked about is the possibility of a red-red-green coalition. So that would be SPD, Social Democrats, and the Green Party and the Left Party, which is a far-left party. So SPD and Greens are saying that they don't see that as a possibility because they see the Left Party as too extreme.
A progressive alliance. They could get Clive Lewis to run it, maybe. So yeah, SPD, Martin Schulz, who cursed, as regular listeners will know, by being bald, which basically makes him unelectable. He had a bit of a Schulz bump, I think, as you alluded to, probably about February, March time, and the SPD had some quite good local election results, and that's tailed off a bit. Is that because somehow they've seen through him, or because, as we've talked about before, although there's probably quite a desire for change in a lot of the parts of the world, I'm guessing Germans are probably looking at Brexit, looking at Trump and going, steady as she goes, Angela Merkel, probably not a bad person to have in a crisis?
Yeah, I think there's a desire for stability. It's actually interesting that we weren't actually sure that Merkel would stand for a fourth term, and she announced that she would just after Trump was elected. Actually, I think she probably felt a kind of responsibility to offer stability at this kind of, you know, Brexit and Trump last year, 2016. We got to the end of that year and it was all going a bit mad.
Yeah, as opposed to now, everything's fine.
Yeah, everything's fine. She has very high personal ratings and she is well respected also on the left, and she has positioned herself solidly in the centre, to the extent that a lot of members of her party are a bit annoyed she's too far centre.
Can't imagine that kind of situation happening here.
No. One thing I'm kind of curious about when it comes to the German elections is what's caused the decline of the Social Democratic Party, because obviously they were riding high, they had that bump, and yet it's just seemed to have gone downhill from there. Is there a root cause to that we know, or is it?
I don't know if I can identify a kind of main cause, but it's also worth remembering that they are in government in coalition with the CDU, and I think it's quite difficult for them to be a clear opposition and to differentiate themselves clearly from the government. Also because Merkel is so clearly in the centre. And actually, I've been reading in Germany lately that German Social Democrats are looking at Corbyn's results in the election because he had this big surge in the polls, and the SPD in Germany are now on 25%. So they're like 14 points behind the CDU. And so they're thinking, well, Corbyn could do it. Maybe the SPD can also have this last minute bump in the polls. Well, he's still got a bit more time.
Maybe we can arrange some sort of job swap. We could talk to Tom Watson. Maybe Martin Schulz can come over and be Labour leader for a bit.
That'd
and Corbyn
be great,
can
yeah.
go over. Just for like a secondment for the campaign.
Yeah. Can we send Seamus Milne with them?
It's kind of like an Erasmus obviously for politicians.
I think. And in reference to our previous episode, Seamus Milne would not go in a container ship to Germany. He would definitely go a fight out of a cannon.
Yeah.
So, alternative for Deutschland, our friendly neighbourhood fascists. How are they doing?
They're not doing as well as they have been at the moment. So they're on about, I think they're on 8%, which that means they'll make it into the Bundestag for the first time, which is a big deal.
It's a 5% threshold.
They have a 5% threshold. So, and that will be the first time that they make it into the Bundestag. So that will be a big deal. But at the same time, there were some regional elections in Germany where they were reaching. So there was one in, but they had 24%.
Is that Bavaria or somewhere?
No, it was Saxony-Anhalt, I think. So they're not doing really comparatively very well at the moment, and I think it's that they've been having leadership struggles and they've also shifted again to the right, so they're now quite clearly a far-right party and have some real neo-Nazis in their ranks who every so often say something outrageous in public and cause big outcry. And the Germans are very wary of far-right parties, and whereas before the AfD were kind of, when they originally started, they weren't really comparable with other Eurosceptic parties or populist parties. They were kind of anti-Euro and kind of economic liberals, but they've just kind of gradually shifted towards now anti-Islam.
It feels like a very UKIP trajectory where, I mean, that was founded by Alan Sked, who is a liberal Tory, is a anti-ERM, anti-Maastricht party, and then was kind of pushed further and further right by people like Nigel Farage, who came into it, became quite popular, a kind of none of the above protest party, but since Brexit has lost a lot of its support and basically tried to then just become more and more and more far right and kind of capture that BNP vote where there isn't really a lot of space there. There's not a lot of.
It's definitely a big factor in their drop in the polls that it's just putting people off, whereas they might have had some sympathy on the euro and on the EU and even on the refugee crisis. Use of really far right rhetoric just turns people off. Again, Brexit and Trump doesn't help.
Yeah. Let's finish off by talking about the only really interesting question, which is, what does it all mean for us? What does a Macron presidency and a presumably a Merkel presidency, either as part of a grand coalition or governing alone, what does that mean in terms of Brexit negotiations, do you think?
Well, when where do
I think,
we start?
Yeah, I think the place to start with this is that both are very pro-EU.
Yeah.
Both are likely to want to position themselves as at the centre of the negotiations. Their pro-EU credentials means that I suspect we may see a bit more hardball. They're both massively in favour of the project. They both want to see it survive. They both want to see it succeed. That works out badly for Britain because it means they're going to just strike a bit more of a hard line in negotiations. That's not to say they're going to try and screw us over for the sake of it, but I do think they're going to be much more vicious in terms of the detail and in instructing and feeding into the negotiations than others would have been.
There's a strong commitment by Merkel and Macron to reinvigorate the Franco-German alliance, which has been in decline, or has been seen as in decline for quite some time, and to be the kind of motor of European integration. So they're now talking about driving forward integration in defence policy and also in creating a more integrated federal Eurozone. But what's really interesting actually about Macron is, so he did this big interview with Guardian, Süddeutsche Zeitung and other centre-left newspapers this week, and he was talking about freedom of movement and kind of acknowledging the role that freedom of movement played in the Brexit referendum. And he was actually saying that the EU needs to think carefully about, not in terms of backing down on freedom of movement, but acknowledging the real concerns that people have about inter-EU migration and things, and the way in which, so he's talking about measures that stop companies undercutting local wages. So there's something called the Posted Workers Directive, which allows companies that are using workers from, for example, Central Eastern Europe member states, they can then pay social insurance for those employees in the home country of the employee, which means they pay much less. Not backing down on freedom of movement, but trying to think of ways that the EU can acknowledge that there are concerns. I mean, their priority is to protect the EU and keep the EU united, but I think it'll be interesting to see what kinds of offers do they make to keep the UK close to the EU.
Yeah, kind of how do you keep the show on the road? Do you keep the project on the road by basically saying, well, because of America's lack of commitment to NATO at the moment under a Trump presidency, we need to do this defence spending. If you're not willing to do that and integrate defence, go? Or do you say, we've got these four freedoms, freedom of movement is non-negotiable, get out? Or as you say, do you maybe try and take a bit more pragmatic role and say, well, as Macron's been saying, the door's still open for Britain to stay in, should it want to do so. He's also been saying, well, if you've got any firms and you want to be part of the EU and have access to the single market after Brexit, well, why don't you come to Paris?
Yeah, he's been deliberately trying to court bankers, deliberately trying to court scientists, deliberately trying to court researchers of all sorts, both from the
experts.
US and Britain.
Disgusting.
Yeah. Just nothing, you know, that unusual. But he's done it in a very obvious, very vocal way. So, for instance, the fact that he's giving these kind of statements about, oh yeah, climate researchers from the US come to France, and he's doing that in English.
That's
a very powerful statement,
yeah.
given that he's French. It will be interesting to see how he is able to balance his desire and also, you know, his job of putting France first versus the wider kind of principles of the EU and kind of the niggly details that can create.
Our theme tune is Plucky Good Times by Dave Depper. That's from freemusicarchive.org, and our logo was designed by James Cram. You can follow him on Twitter at James Cram. I'm at Paperback Writer.
I'm at Centre Radical.
And I'm not on Twitter.
You radical. You academics in your ivory towers. Speak to you soon.